you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, Ben, we're getting ready to go here. Just want to give you a heads up. I'm looking for something to play on Lumpin' Radio tomorrow. So, I don't know. Let's try to watch the language on this show. And I think this one could air for Lumpin' Radio. Find us on Lumpin' Radio, WLPN, Chicago, 105.5 FM, Fridays at noon. So, yeah, keep it clean. And I think this one could air on the show.
I want an answer. It's not something you ignore.
I think you're 100% full of shit is what I think. If you think we
want offense, well, fuck you then.
Come on.
You're going to tell me I'm friends? Full of shit.
Starting now. Your Ben Jarofsky Show for Thursday, January 20th. January, why are you leaving so soon? My God, you went by so fast. This brought to you by SEIU Healthcare, Illinois, Indiana.
I want an answer.
The Chicago Federation of Labor.
I want an answer.
The Chicago Teachers Union.
I want an answer.
And, of course, Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com for all things there is to know the city of Chicago. Where to go, what to do, what to eat, what to drink, what kind of reefer to smoke, and so much more. Yeah, we're calling it reefer, all right? Including columns from our very own Ben Jarofsky. Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com. And if you want to help out this program, you can. ChicagoReader.com/Jarofsky. JORAV is in victory. SKY. It is Thursday, January 20th. And this is the Ben Jarofsky Show. Why are we dancing? Just dancing. Today on the program, Anna Foyer and the long-awaited return of our dear friend, Kenny D. Ken Davis. And now your host, Chicago Reader columnist Ben Jarofsky.
Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this Bright One Thursday, and here's why. Good news from beloved Bright One. My beloved Chicago Sun-Times, home delivered every day, as Dennis knows, of keeping the paper alive with my subscription. You're welcome, Sun-Times.
Still doing that, huh?
Still doing it. Still. And I do it for the tribunal, too. Okay? Here we go. You see? I get it. Even with the hedge fund, I get it. Anyway, so we talked about this a little bit yesterday. We'll have taking a deep dive with young Kenneth Davis, who will be our guest coming up in a little while. Guy knows more about media in Chicago than anyone else around. Not named Rob Feeder. Yeah, I said it, ladies and gentlemen.
Ooh, you hear that, Feeder?
I said not named Rob Feeder. I gave Feeder a shout out, okay? Feeder's number one, Kenny D's number two. So, anyway, so the story that everyone in the media is talking about, it's the buzz of the media. It's the buzz of the media.
That's what it sounded like to me.
When reporters get together, would you hear about this? Reporters getting together. Anyway, WBEZ and my beloved Bright One, the Chicago Sun-Times, are forming a joint venture. And I guess the way to look at it is BEZ is taking over to Sun-Times. Sun-Times is going to become like an entity of BEZ. This will guarantee, according to the press releases and the statements by the officials in charge, that the Sun-Times will stay in operation. So I say, here, I love the Sun-Times. I really do. All kidding is, I know I like to tease the Sun-Times, the Bright One, and, you know, reminisce about the good old days when we were back in the studio.
Well, you know, maybe we need to show up in that building now and try and work out a deal to get that studio back. Got it.
I love that studio. You know, they said, by the way, an interesting point, you should mention that, D. Very good. Good transition.
Oh, my God. Are we getting our studio back?
In the story that they're probably going to move away from that old building, the old headquarters because there's no need for all that space. I'm like, well, let's us go back. We'll go back to that little studio.
Yeah.
Just give us the keys. We'll go. I love that studio.
Give us that little room. That's all we want to pay for.
That little room just down the hall from the bathroom. I never held it against you that you still stuck us by the bat.
We may be able to cut a deal, just saying.
Some people would walk in and go, I was looking for the bathroom. This does not look like a bathroom to me.
Or like I would give them I would walk them into the studio and they're like seeing all the nice things. And then all of a sudden they're going towards the bathroom. Like, where am I going?
Where am I going and why am I going there? Our guest, Anna Foyer, has joined us. We're going to bring her on a little bit. But before I do, let me just finish my thoughts about this. So WBEZ will take control of the Chicago Sun-Times. They will be two separate operations, as I understand, but one will maybe a lot of collaboration. So, you know, the investigative reporters of the Bright One will join investigative reporters from BEZ for joint ventures. I don't know if you know this, D, but a couple of the outstanding investigative reporters for WBEZ are themselves former Sun-Times reporters. Did you know that?
I know one of them.
Well, for 10 trivia points, which one?
Damianopoulos.
There we go. Young Daniel used to work for the Bright One. And Dave McKinney used to work for the Bright One as well. So maybe they'll do some joint ventures, and I urge them to do so. But it was interesting. After the story broke that the very convoluted contraption they set up to preserve the Sun-Times, and again, we'll be talking about it in greater detail with Ken Davis, Eric Zorn, dear friend of the show, Eric Zorn, wrote in his newsletter that he publishes once a week. He was opining on the deal and what it says about journalism. But then he had this one little shot, which I will now read. And you should know before I read this is that the joint venture is being propped up to a large degree with contributions from the MacArthur Foundation, one of the leading foundations in the city of Chicago. They got a lot of money, ladies and gentlemen. And anytime they want to kick a little more money over to Ben Jarofsky's show, we will not say no. You think they're going to give a lefty like me in my attic any money, D? I don't think so. Not when I have lefties like Anna Foyer coming on the show all the time, troublemakers like that. Eric Zorn wrote this. Where were these foundations when my former colleagues at the Tribune were desperately looking for big money people to save the paper from the clutches of the hedge fund that has now taken over? Well, Eric, I will now answer the question. Where were they? They were running away from the Tribune. And I try to warn you, Tribsters, about this. You guys were so insane with your editorials for so long. You were so bad. I can't swear because this is the... I caught myself.
There we go.
You were so crazy. Can't swear because this is what's going on Lumpin' Radio, ladies and gentlemen. You were so crazy, so right-wing crazy all those years. Who in Chicago, really, except for like the extreme MAGA, like far right MAGAites, who could support you? All those crazy anti-union editorials. This is a union town. You wanted to destroy the Chicago Teachers Union. You supported Bruce Rauner's efforts to destroy collective bargaining rights in the state of Illinois. Who could support that in Chicago? And let's not even get into your weird theories about public education. The way to save public education is to cut funding to public education. Like that one editorial you wrote where you were hoping for like a hurricane to destroy the schools of Chicago so we could start anew, like happened in New Orleans. Never mind, I don't think we've ever had a hurricane in the state of Illinois ever. Guys could use a little help with the geography weather thing. I don't think we get hurricanes. Anyway, that's my... There's a consequence, ultimately, I think, for that kind of just out-of-touch insanity. Right-wing insanity. And so I'm going to give a little shout-out to young Tom McNamee. Nobody talks about him anymore. Remember young Tom, D?
Oh, yeah.
He was the middle of the road, straight down the main highway, right on that middle line. Editorial writer for the Chicago Sun-Times. He came on the show a few times back when we were at the Bright One. And, you know, Tom and I would argue. We didn't see things eye to eye, but it was very cordial, respectful, arguments, debates. But I got to think that middle-of-the-road approach may have saved the Sun-Times, because I don't think there's a foundation in the city of Chicago that would want anything to do with the right-wing drivel that was being...
What?
Broadcast into the universe all those years by the Tribune. So that's my answer to the question, Eric. I'll bring you back in the show and we'll have a debate on that. I know, respectful debate. I think Eric kind of represents like the Tom McNamee person that can come on and debate me from the center. Anyway, got that off my chest. We'll be discussing more about the collaborative, the new, the union between the Sun-Times and WBZ. I'm bringing back as my guest, Anna Foyer, who's going to take a victory lap. You may remember her from, Anna, when were you on the show last? About a month ago? I've lost track of time.
I was going to say, about a month ago.
Yes. So, first of all, welcome back, Cotter, to the show. Thank you for coming back to the show. And things must have gone okay the first appearance that you returned. Anna is an employee with the Art Institute, and we talked when she was first on the show about the union efforts at the Art Institute. The employees had decided they were going to form a union, and there was a vote on it. And I'm going to let Anna play WBEZ reporter, Sun-Times reporter, and announce the results of the vote. So take it away, our correspondent from the Art Institute. Anna, yes. Take it away.
Coming to you live from Ukrainian Village, remote reporting. Yes, last Tuesday, the Art Institute of Chicago portion of the AIC WU, we had our vote and had a resounding victory. 140 odd votes to 40 against. So that's about, it's almost an 80% margin. And even more impressive than that is the museum challenged over 40 ballots, but that balance didn't matter because all of the yes votes came out strong and we had an overwhelming victory. And then the following day, last Wednesday, the school also won their vote with a very similar margin. It was really just a couple differences on either side, but another resounding victory for the school, the Art Institute of Chicago. So both units of AIC WU won our union votes. We are a union workplace now.
That's excellent. And by the way, I'm a member of the Art Institute. I'm happy that I am supporting an institution that has a unionized workforce. And before, I should have done this before we started. I did this the last time. I urge everybody at the Art Institute who's listening to this, if you are listening to it, board members included, I urge absolutely every single one of you to respect Anna's rights as an American citizen to speak her mind. And I do not want to hear that there's any punishment for Anna coming on this show. And I say that every time I have a union person come on this show who's talking about unionizing, I always feel I have to, I'm compelled to say that because MAGA has First Amendment rights to say whatever they want, but MAGA's never there when the Annas of the world want to speak up on behalf of themselves and their colleagues. So please, Art Institute board members, let Anna have her First Amendment protected rights. Okay, that need be said. All right, I'm not going to do any trash talking, even though I'm about to do some trash talking. You know, at the Reader, our vote to unionize was 100%, Anna. I had to get that out of the way, but congratulations.
Thank you.
So 80%, that's pretty good. And then you're right. I don't know if people understand what you were saying, but they challenged some of the ballots of people saying they weren't eligible. Explain what that means, Anna.
Right. So there are people who are legally not allowed to be part of a union. Very broad strokes is, you know, people who have access to personal information, financial information. So, for example, HR people or supervisors and managers. And that's where a lot of the challenges came from, is the museum saying that certain positions are actually managerial positions or supervisory positions. And it's a pretty typical anti-union tactic to try and whittle down the size of the bargaining unit as much as possible. We've seen that with the New York Times and their anti-union tactics there. So they're saying that, you know, various people aren't eligible. They're allowed to bring up these challenges and have them resolved if they so choose, and we agree. But given that the margin of victory was so overwhelming, you know, we're happy to let all the challenges slide. And yeah, I mean, that just is another proof for how strong this yes vote was, but it also speaks to how effective the anti-union measures taken by different workplaces are. You know, there were a few dozen no votes there. You know, we don't know how many no votes there were amongst the challenged ballots, but it's also a testament to how hungry people were for change and for a voice that so many people came out with the yes vote to support our efforts to come together and form a union.
And so what were some of the compelling reasons for supporting the union?
Well, I mean, in the days following our victory, you know, amongst just celebrating, hooting and hollering and all that good stuff, a lot of people were just so happy that they'll have to listen to us. You know, the main line that they've had in their anti-union campaign is, you don't need a union because we already listen to you. You have all these avenues to communicate with us and we're always listening, but we know from our lived experience that that's not true. And so to have a structure in place where we have a voice, we have an equal seat at the table with them to say how our employment works, that is a huge deal for us. And the point that we're at right now, you know, we're figuring out the details of what we're actually specifically going to ask for in our contract. So we're sending out surveys, we're talking, we're listening, we're trying to speak to the people who did vote no, because their voices matter just as much as everyone who voted yes. We're all part of this union now, so everyone who has something to say should be heard. So while the specifics are going to be worked out in the next few weeks, the main thing is that we're here now. We have an actual seat at the table, and that is the most important thing to us, where we have things to say, we have concerns, we have things that we want to support, and now they have to listen to that.
Anna, that's a very important point. I'd love you, like for you to elaborate a little bit. Reaching out to the people who voted no, and by my calculations, 20%, not including the 14 ballots that were not permitted to be counted, 20% voted no. Well, how about that for math? I went to Evanston High School, ladies and gentlemen. So what were their some of their concerns for that they voiced to explain why they voted no, and how will you address them going forward?
You know, the things that the museum said to get people to question whether or not a union was right for a workplace is effective. You know, there's a reason the boss, no matter where you work, makes the same arguments over and over and over again. People hear it and they think, huh, that might be true, you know, insinuating that we're going to come after people's benefits, that our pay is going to be lowered, that, you know, the union dues are going to suck us dry, you know, all of these things. When you come after people's money, that's a very convincing argument. And the truth of the matter is, when you look at how wages are improved in workplaces that unionize, you know, the minuscule percentage that goes to our union dues, which goes to helping protect us and our rights as workers, it is well worth it. And we have the ability to vote down any contract that we feel isn't worth that money. So there are things like that. But then, you know, it's hard to communicate during a pandemic. People didn't feel heard. And we just have to go out there and say, listen, we've always been listening. We're listening now. Come to us, speak with us. Your voice matters and we want to hear it. So that's been our line all along. It's going to continue to be what we do throughout this whole process. And it's even more important now than ever as we actually get to, you know, the meat and potatoes of what our union is going to look like.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. The meat and potatoes, which starts with contract negotiations. When I always brag about how the reader was 100%, what I leave out is the agonizing. I think it was like 2 years trek through the desert of the contract negotiations with the then owners, long since passed, who wanted nothing to do with the union at the reader. And so used every trick in the book, including I could give you guys a whole dissertation on what they're going to do, including lectures on the Taft-Hartley Labor Act during negotiations. Ted, I see you. That was their negotiator. Come on, Ted. I remember when he was lecturing about Taft-Hartley. Do you anticipate that some of the same delay tactics will be employed by the good folks at the Art Institute, or do you think they're going to be a little quicker to negotiate?
You know, they've said that they, you know, are coming to the table in good faith. And I hope that that's true. That's how we're coming to the table. You know, we won our vote. And for me personally, a lot of the frustrations and apprehensions I was feeling have dissipated since that vote happened, because, you know, we're here. We have all of these protections. We have this pathway forward. We have been working in good faith from the beginning, and that's how we're coming. And, you know, I want to take them at their word. You know, this is all about improving the Art Institute of Chicago. When the workers are happy, the workplace is happy. And when the workplace is happy, the people who come into the museum's doors see that effort. You know, this is all about our pride in our institution and the work that we do. We just feel like we need better support. So as long as everybody is acting in good faith, I see no reason for this not to go smoothly. But, you know, we'll have to see how it goes.
Be warned of any mention by the other side, the negotiator for the other side, of the Taft-Hartley Act. You know you're in tough situation if he starts lecturing you about the Taft-Hartley
Act. I'll have to do some Googling after this.
From the 1940s. All right. So let's talk about larger trends going on. We talked a little bit about this the last time we were in the show, but I've been thinking about this, Anna, since you were on the show. And by the way, just a shout out, I'm going to have some Starbucks employees on the show later today. We're going to do an interview about efforts to organize Starbucks in Chicago. So I'm going to put Starbucks aside and talk about sort of the organizing, for lack of a better word, white collar professionals. I'm seeing it more and more. It's not the Reader. It took forever for the Reader to finally, the folks at the Reader to realize, hey, you know, we could use a union. That was like 2014, I think it was. I've lost track of time. But I've seen it now. NPR, I just alluded to NPR. I remember when they organized their union. I'm seeing more and more like librarians who are in the private sector organizing unions. Unions themselves are organizing, like have union affiliates of the staff of unions. And there was a sense, I thought, and I'd like to address this, that like working at the Art Institute may have been a dream job for someone because they love art. Or working in a library may have been a dream job for someone because they love book collections and they love working with the book collections. Or working as a reporter may have been a dream job because you had this image of yourself as the next Woodward or Bernstein. And then the reality is, oh my God, it's a job and I have to organize a union. Do you think there's a larger trend going on here where more people in white collar professionals trades are now realizing that they have a lot in common with auto workers or garbage haulers, etc.?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we are living in a moment where people in all manner of industries, like all the ones you just mentioned now, are realizing that unless and until you guarantee legally that your rights are protected, they're going to be taken advantage of. I mean, we've seen that manifested so many times in so many ways in our country's history, and it's always a fight to have those rights recognized. And I think in these workplaces where you are promised something in return, whether it's the satisfaction of the work that you're doing or, you know, a nice amount of vacation time, whatever it is that your workplace has promised you, that will often come at the expense of livable wages or exploitation. And so unless and until you come together with your coworkers and say, we need to have our workplace solidified in a way that works for us and makes our time worthwhile, it's not going to happen. And especially with museums, and, you know, we've talked to people at different museums like the PMA, the Walker Center, all of these other museums that at the same time as we are forming unions. You know, there's so many people in a museum. It's not just the quote unquote white collar jobs. There are plenty of quote unquote blue collar jobs as well. And that was part of why we wanted to have as broad of a bargaining unit as possible. You know, our custodians, they're just as short staffed as anyone else, and they are essential to the functioning of a museum. I work very closely with them to help protect the integrity of the collections from dangerous pests. You know, all of our work is tied together and we're all taken advantage of in the same ways. And so it behooves us to protect each other, to say, you have problems, I have problems, and the only way to address these problems is to have people listen to us. When we say we need more staff, they say, okay, let's work together to make that happen. So it doesn't matter what job you do or what your workplace is, that danger of exploitation is always there. And especially when you have people who are very passionate about their work and who work in the nonprofit world, understanding that, you know, that's a very different world than a Fortune 500, we get taken advantage of because they rely on our goodwill to just put up with crappy conditions, which we shouldn't have to do. You know, we're trying to make a living. We're trying to put food on the table. There's no reason we shouldn't actually be making a living.
You know, it's love of the job sometimes undercuts you. You ever say, oh, I love, this is my dream job. I've always wanted to do fill in the blank, whatever it is. And so they got to kind of got you there. You know what I'm saying? Well, I'll put up with less pay. I was just talking to someone who was organized, spent a little while organizing actors, trying to organize actors. And he said it was a very challenging and difficult assignment because they wanted their work. They wanted to be seen. And so in many cases, that meant non-equity because you can't afford it. The equity pay scale would make it unaffordable to put the show on. So that undercut the actors. Now, it's interesting, once they become successful, then, of course, everything changes. Since you formed your union, or since you began the unionizing efforts, have you been receiving questions or queries from other museums or people in similar professions looking for advice?
Yeah, I mean, we were one of those museums. You know, when we were still behind the scenes, well before we went public at the beginning of this year, we were talking to people from the Walker Center because they were, you know, a step ahead of us in the process. And, you know, it's all about supporting each other, having other museum workers there to give us advice, to tell us how it went for them, to show us the things that they were able to achieve with their contracts. That is huge for us. And as you know, we're not the first major museum to organize, but we're the first major institution in Chicago to organize. And so it's our hope that all of these other museums see what we were able to do, see how we're able to protect ourselves, to provide for ourselves, and understand that they can do it too. So that solidarity is incredibly important. And it's something, you know, I've heard the word solidarity said for many years, but it wasn't until we started this unionization process that I actually felt what that was, not just within the museum, becoming friends with, you know, sharing problems with people who I'd never spoken to before because they work literally on the other side of the museum campus. You know, that connection is so important. And it, regardless of how your vote turns out, those connections that you form will remain there. So between museums, between your own coworkers, that to me has been the greatest part about this process, is just connecting with people.
You know, Anna, this is mainly a political show. We do a lot of conversations about politics, national and local, and everybody who comes on the show, I'm not going to ask you to do this, but makes projections as to who will capture the Congress and the Senate in the midterm elections. And pretty much everybody is who comes on my show is of the leftist persuasion, and they're a little disenchanted and because they feel Republicans have the upper hand right now. And I find this a curious contradiction, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. Where the country seems to be heading back toward Republican control, which is, I can't quite understand that in any way. At the same time, I'm watching the Art Institute employees and the Starbucks employees and other entities making an effort to form a union to protect their rights. And I'm starting to see labor sort of coming to life a little bit and challenging just sort of the way business has been done in this country, Amazon even. Do you see any larger trends at play here when you look at what you went down at the Art Institute that may, you know, have an impact on I don't know who wins the midterms or the future politically of our country?
Well, that depends on the Democrats being able to seize on a popular message, which, you know, good luck. I hope they can do it. But unionization is a very, very popular message. 1 in 2 Americans say that they would like to be part of a union if they could, but only 1 in 10 actually is. So this is something that is incredibly popular, and it is something that should be bipartisan. Regardless of your political persuasion, you likely have a job. And in that workplace, are you protected? Are you being exploited? Do you have a voice? You know, this isn't something that should depend on how you vote. It should be you are out there trying to provide for yourself, for your family, just make a living so one day you can retire. You know, these are things that should unite all of us. And so I think it would definitely be wise to seize on this moment because it is a moment. I mean, all of these workplaces are coming together, are seizing on their union power. So if a politician were to support that message, to come out and say, hey, this is important, we need to support the working people of America, I think that would be a very popular message. And you would get a few more votes if that were the message you were sending to people. But again, that would require, you know, some kind of chutzpah from the Democrats. And yeah, we'll see.
We shall see. Let's just repeat that. I want to make sure I got that right. And because I'd never heard that before. Did you say 1 in 2 Americans wants to be in a union? It's, did I hear you correctly? One, yes, so 50%, in other words?
I did an interview with Stephen Greenhouse on Chicago Tonight, and he is, you know, a decades-long labor writer from the New York Times for many, many, many years. And yes, that is something that he said, and he would know better than anyone. And I see it out there. You know, this is why we're seeing more and more workplaces form unions and try to form unions and fight for unions, because so many people understand that it is a positive thing. And it's unfortunate that anti-union propaganda has so infested our culture that even people on the left have their doubts, think that, you know, it's the Jimmy Hoffa days where the money is just going to go into one person's pocket and you'll never see any benefits from it. You know, the conversations that we had at AIC Woo, convincing people that this actually is going to be a positive thing, those were things that we heard. People were afraid that they were going to get taken advantage of by some, you know, mob boss figure, which, given our country's history and especially Chicago's history, it's, you know, a somewhat reasonable thing. But this is the 21st century. AFSCME represents museums all across the country. You know, all it took was laying out the actual facts of what a union workplace looks like. And people were like, oh, I had no idea. Oh, that's how it works? Great, sign me up. So there's a lot of very effective propaganda that's been broadcast out for decades and decades. So both the left and the right have been convinced by that propaganda, but it is something that can and should unionize us, you know, yeah. Bring us together.
I will, maybe this is for a topic for another show, so I'm going to resist the temptation right now to defend Jimmy Hoffa. who is a much maligned figure, I believe, in American history. And was a great union man. He built a powerful union. And he did use the mob. That is correct. And he got in bed with the mob. There's no doubt about that. And it ultimately led to his execution, his murder. But he defended himself, Anna, and I, by saying, oh, what about the mobsters who are lined up with the auto titans? What about that? That's, are you just gonna look the other way at that? You know, I got my mobsters, they got their mobsters, everybody's got a mobster.
I mean, yeah, my great uncle Jack, when he was helping unionize Illinois Bell, he fought with mobsters on the street, you know, and he was trying to form the union. They were trying to bust the union. It was a mess, but that was decades ago. You know, things are better now.
Uncle Jack, man, I wish I could have met him. Sounds like a really cool guy. Anna, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it. And congratulations on your victory. And I'm not going to crow about how we had 100%, because 80% is pretty damn good. So again, congratulations and good luck going forward with negotiations.
Yes, thank you so much. Thanks for having me back. Give my solidarity to the Starbucks workers you talked to. I wish them all the best.
I know I don't have to make this request of you, but I'm going to do it anyway. This show is going to be sent to Lumpen Radio, and so just try not to swear. Joining us now from the northwest side of Chicago is perhaps the foremost authority on all things media in the city of Chicago, not named Rob Feeder, and that would be Ken Davis. Welcome back, Cotter.
Well, thanks, Ben. It's a pleasure to be with you. Actually, you know, I've moved to Aurora because I like the mayor out here better. So.
Irvin, Richard Irvin. Ken Davis Richard Irvin for a long time. Ken Davis was a regular on our show for many, many years. Well, the show was only been going for 3 years, but he was a regular about once a month, once every 6 weeks. And then he decided he was going to go into retirement. It was like Michael Jordan retiring from basketball. And I believe you were playing baseball for a while and then you gave up on that.
yeah.
And then out of nowhere, I was like begging him, Dennis, come, please, Ken, come back to the show, please. No, I'm busy. I'm an important man. I don't have time for your little show. And then out of nowhere, he said, oh, all right, I'll come back. So
if only like 50% of that were true. But yeah,
I would say it's like a Tribune editorial from back in the days. I'd say roughly 5% of what I said was true. There's a sprinkling
of
truth.
Enough of a nugget there that it has credibility. Yeah,
we'll get into that. I already opened the show.
A more accurate description would be that I kept telling you, no, I really just don't want to do it, Ben. I don't feel like I have anything to say. I'm too out of it. I don't know anything. Your guests are so much smarter than I am. That's more like what.
That's more like it. Yeah. He was going through his Greta Garbo phase. I didn't want to be Barbie. anyway, as people know from the old days, Ken Davis for many years had a public affairs show on cable TV here in Chicago. And before that, he worked for Mayor Daley. He worked on the other side. He was a publicist for the city. And before that, I always give him credit. He doesn't like when I give him credit for this. He pretty much invented the WBEZ newsroom. He definitely invented their pledge drives, for better or for worse.
Could I interrupt just for a moment? This is it's really nice. It's nice of you to have to work out my obituary this way. But I just want to point out something that I discovered along the way here.
Yes.
The last appearance I made on your show was exactly 1 year ago today.
Whoa.
So it's been a year, Jen, a year. But then, you know how Facebook does this weird thing when you log into Facebook and it shows you something that they've selected from this day in history that they think you'd really like to see?
Yes.
Well, what popped up this morning was you on Chicago Newsroom 3 years ago today.
Whoa.
You had just left your employment. You were working at some little radio station somewhere. I can't remember the name of it. And you were talking about, you came to sit at the table and talk to me and air your grievances. Except for the part about how much you enjoyed the omelet. You did like the omelet. That was free.
That is, I love indulging my grievances. Of course, the radio station was WC later, Ben. I got fired for having a big mouth. And they set me up like a bowling pin about 2 weeks before I got fired. The station manager, whose name escapes me at the time, but I know Dennis could tell it if he wanted to, took me out for a delicious breakfast at a restaurant in Jefferson Park. It was absolutely delicious.
At Ellie's, Elle's or whatever it is.
Yeah. And he goes, and it's like, oh, you're doing a great job, guy. And then we started talking about the Bulls. It was like 5 minutes of talking about me and 20 minutes talking about the Bulls. And then 2 weeks later, they fire me. I'm like, you know what? The mob's got nothing on these liberal types at WCLA later, Ben.
Anyway, well, that's radio for you.
That's radio. Yeah. And we'll get into that. I was just going to do this free flow discussion with Ken about going walking through the city of Chicago, because that was really, like, he does a lot of walking, and so do I. I was really into that. But Ken Davis is an organized man, ladies and gentlemen. So he sent me, since I wasn't going to come up with the show's agenda, Dennis, he sent me the agenda. Okay. Oh, Ben, this is what we're going to talk about. So I have two.
Well, I'd had a year to prepare. So, you know.
have 1 year to prepare. And so on the agenda is a discussion, a tribute to Les Grobstein and a tribute to radio that we grew up with in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. We'll hold that off for the baby boomers so we don't lose every millennial that we might have.
Not another discussion about the 60s.
Oh God, these geezers.
But you know, kids, it really was the best. It really was the best.
It was.
I mean, ever. Yeah.
I mean. The highlight of this discussion will be the BEZ Sun Times merger, which I've already discussed. And then we really want to bore people. We'll have a deep discussion of the transit TIF and the impact it's had on the. We did a discussion, a pre-show plan. What can we do to drive every single listener away from the show? I know.
You're making me feel really welcome after a year. See why I don't do this very often?
So let's just start with BEZ and Sun Times. And they have their merger, and there's going to be a new entity. I'm not quite sure when this baby will take place, but sometime down the road. I missed that in Ken, when they're going to actually.
No, they're not announcing it yet.
I see. Okay.
Before
we take the deep dive into all your thoughts on it, I got to say, I started the show with some observations based on something our dear friend Eric Zorn wrote in his newsletter.
Yes.
And Eric was lamenting in his newsletter that part of the reason.
You're a loser.
It's sore loser. Eric Ken said that, not me. And that he's disappointed. He wanted to know where the foundations were when he and his other tripsters were desperately calling on corporate Chicago to come to their rescue to keep it from being devoured by a hedge fund, which has devoured it and effectively, well, it's hard to say it's destroyed the Tribune, but it's really cut it away deeply. My response, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, is that the foundations have been scared away in part by the right-wing drivel and ideology that had been broadcast by the Tribune's editorial board and its leading columnist, John Cass, for many years, that was so out of line with where even just the most centrist of centrist Chicagoans was. Not even where I am on the far left, Ken, but like where the center is in Chicago, that I can't imagine any foundation wanting anything to do with it. That was just my initial response to it. And then I gave a shout out to Tommy McNamee, who ran the Sun-Times and is very much a centrist and positioned their editorial board right down the middle.
I thought brilliantly, by the way, yeah.
Okay, so that's my theory. Do you share my theory, or do you think I'm off? Go ahead.
Actually, yes, I think that's definitely a part of it. I agree with the fact that it was something that made the money people a little bit jittery. But I do think, though, that there's a bigger issue, and this is where I guess maybe I have to take some issue with my dear old friend, Mr. Zorn. I think that the two cases are just, there's almost nothing, they have almost nothing in common. The Tribune was just laden with debt because, first of all, we have to start like a little brief history here. Mm-hmm. Remember that long before Alden Capital came in, the other robber barons who had bought the Tribune from other robber barons came up with the great idea that they would cut the company in half, except it wouldn't be half. It would be like 7/8 and 1/8. And they would put all the good stuff, the TV channels and everything else, and you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of assets into the one half. And then they would take all of the debt that all these other entities had and slam it onto the newspaper and create another division of the company called Tribune Publishing, which would own the Tribune and a bunch of other newspapers around the country, including the Los Angeles Times at the time, but and then a bunch of other newspapers, many of them significant but smaller. And suddenly they're the proud recipients of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in debt that they never incurred.
Yeah.
And then they sold the building and to make it condos, and they walked out the door with pretty much all the money. And the newspapers were left bereft. And I believe that, of course, none of us knows this, but my theory is that the money guys at the various charities looked at this and said, there's no way. These numbers just don't add up. And that's kind of what happened later on when there were all these efforts to try to sell the Tribune, to maybe to pull the Tribune out of that bucket, and all lots of other things being done. But I think that the Tribune was just such, not the Tribune, the company that held the Tribune was such a fiscal mess that just nobody wanted to go near it. And I think that was for the money guys, that was probably at least as important as anything political. And I think by comparison, the Sun-Times is a pretty cut and dry situation. They're a very small, kind of hapless operation at this point. They have very little money, and they have been reduced to a shadow of what they once were, as have all newspapers. But the important thing about the Sun-Times, and I think this is really critical, is that under this most recent iteration, this most recent management, they've been able to get themselves out from underneath, I believe, all of their debt. So they're a debt-free operation. They're very, you know, skin and bones, but they are and they are losing money, but it's manageable. And these public service organizations can come in, and yes, they can contribute some money to help fill the holes that are there, but they're not trying to pay off a former company's debt in holding, you know, that they just squeezed out of all the TV stations and threw into the papers. So I think it's, I just don't think the two are comparable. And I guess I kind of differ with my friend Eric on that. It's not a matter of the foundations came in and looked at it and then walked away. They were scared off by a lot of really scary numbers.
Yeah. Listen to your, recitation there, it brought back a conversation I had with another a frequent guest on my show, a far leftist persuasion, my good friend and neighbor Sam Holloway, who comes mm-hmm. on the show just to really remind folks what a leftist voice is. One time we had a conversation, I don't know where how we got onto it, about Detroit and what happened to Detroit and the quote unquote fall of Detroit. And his response, and so I said, well, Sam, in your humble opinion, what's the matter with Detroit? And his one word answer was capitalism.
Yeah.
And yeah. when you were giving that history of the relatively concise history of the Tribune and all its wheeling and dealing, and just the notion of putting all the debt into one company, just laddening one company with all that debt, you know, one division of this empire with all mm-hmm. that debt, so the other side of the ledger is so profitable that you could sell it off for more. It's such a cynical ploy.
Yes.
And that only capitalists could come up with it. Do you follow what I'm saying? It's like,
and the mob, but I guess those are capitalists too.
Yeah, capitalists. It's like a mobster move. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to put all the proceeds right. in this offshore yeah. company. And if you ask any questions, we'll cut your list. And right. meanwhile, if I could tie the two together, if I could for the moment. Meanwhile, while this has gone on, okay, annihilating this perfectly good company, the mouthpiece, the editorial mouthpiece, is haranguing the citizens of Chicago against yeah. leftist unions and collective right. bargaining right. and just do what your bosses say because they know what's best. I'm like, guys, right. do you even know what happened to the company you work for? Are you even aware? Sorry.
Yeah. So, where do we begin? So what do you think about this? What do you think about the merger? Do you like
anything,
it? Merger yeah, or acquisition? It's an acquisition. It's not a merger. It's an acquisition. But what do you
for
think?
For nothing. It was sold for nothing. Correct? Do I have mm-hmm. that right?
Like, yeah.
When you say
well, no cash. Yeah.
No cash.
Yeah,
uh-huh. So for instance, if yeah. I want to acquire something, if I want to buy the Sun-Times, literal copy of the newspaper, that will cost mm-hmm. me more money than buying the company costs. Is that correct? Am I correct with that?
Well,
yes. All right, let me ask you this. Here's a trivia question for young Ben Davis. If I want to purchase
this clearly demonstrates your lack of understanding of complicated capital issues.
Yes. Oh, you put me in a room with Michael Sachs, the brainiac who engineered this thing. I'll walk out with no money in my pockets going, what happened? What just happened? And Sachs will be like, all right. So for 10 trivia points, Ken Davis, if you want to buy a yeah. copy of today's Chicago Sun-Times in the city of Chicago, how much will it cost you?
I'm looking.
Now you're cheating.
I thought I'd be able to come up with, a dollar. Oh, my God.
Yes.
A dollar in the city and $2 in the suburb.
$2 in the suburbs. I'm like, why? Why do you charge more in the suburbs? And I mean,
oh no. You know what? I misread that. It's $1 in the city and suburbs, and it's $2 elsewhere. So all you folks in Newark who want to buy a copy of Chicago Sun-Times, you better have $2 ready. Wow, you know, I had never looked at that. I mean, I had no idea what it was. A dollar. Wow.
A dollar. It costs a full dollar, which is $1 more than the company cost. Now, just want to point that out. Now, look, here's what I say. I say I really love the journalists at the Chicago Sun-Times, even if I don't agree with
them
100%. So if it saves their jobs, I'm for it 100%. And I know where journalism is going. I see with my beloved Reader. We're going to the nonprofit mm-hmm. model. You invented it, Kenneth. You invented it. You came up with a listener-supported radio.
I invented National Public Radio and all the, and then I invented
the internet.
I invented absolutely nothing. But yeah,
wait a minute, you came up with the first pledge drive. Don't be that modest.
No, I didn't. Public radio stations were doing pledge drives as early as 1974.
Wait a minute,
the first pledge drives.
Hold on. Have I been saying something that's false for the last 2 years? Oops.
God help us. No.
Well, I give you credit for getting it at BZ.
So, I've heard you say that, and it gives me a little giggle when I hear it. But no, the first, let's see, 1978, I volunteered. I went down to WBEZ as a listener, as a volunteer to help with the pledge drive. And it was like a 7-day pledge drive or something. I don't know the exact numbers, but I think they raised something like $20,000 from their few listeners. And then the next year, I was fortunate enough to have been hired. I was hired as the news director, and I was paid just a little over $3, I think $3.39 an hour. Mm-hmm. For the next 4 years or so as the news director. So the kid who was really by and large the first news director at WBEZ, earning $3.50 an hour, that company just acquired the Sun Times. Told me that in 1979. Because at that time, you know, Roger Ebert was flying high. The paper was about an inch and a half thick every day. It was a little different those days.
Those days were different. And it was interesting because going back to our favorite topic, how much better things were in the 60s and 70s, where when the articles first came out promoting the merger, the acquisition, what have you, the joining of these two entities, they talked about all the greats. And it was like greats from the past. They talked about Roger Ebert and Cup. And I'm like, what millennial in the city of Chicago knows who Cup is? You know what I'm saying? Wow, it's that long ago? You can't talk about any of the people that are right there now. You know what I'm saying? They go back. Mm-hmm. And they left Royko's name off, too, by the way. I don't know who was. Mike Royko used to work for the Sun Times.
Yes, he sure did.
So I'm happy for it. Ken, I realize that this is, I don't agree with a lot of the criticisms that have been published by Rob Feeder, et cetera. He quoted Dan Miller of the, who used to work for Cranes. Yeah. And I'll get your reaction.
And was an editor at the Sun Times. He was business editor at the Sun Times for a number of years.
Yes. I remember when he was the business editor. And he's applying the old model, like a Crane Chicago business model. He's applying a model when newspapers can raise revenues through advertising that no longer exists in the universe.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, my reaction when I saw that was, but Dan, you know, again, like I just had said earlier, remember that what you were talking about was the Sun Times of 2 years ago, which was really bleeding money like crazy. And they were indebted in so many ways, and they're not. The people who've been running the Sun Times and managing the Sun Times the last couple of years have done a really good job of kind of taking care of the things you need to take care of to dress it up and make it ready for an acquisition. And they got a good acquisition, if you ask me. I think this is a good marriage, and I think that it will. I'm not gonna predict that it's gonna work or not work because nobody knows. But they've got as good a shot here as I think almost anybody in the country has of making this work, and I'm really kind of excited about it. I mean, I think it's you know, like you, Ben, I just love the Sun Times. I always have. I mean, since I was a kid, and I don't want the Sun Times to go away. And I obviously have a lot of affection for the old radio station that I worked at, and the idea of the two of them coming together to me is just a really exciting prospect. There are issues, and one of them that I haven't seen explored very much is, and I truly don't know the answer to this. I spent some time this morning trying to look it up and see if I could find an answer, but you might know something about this with the reader too. Can a not-for-profit newspaper run for-profit ads? I don't know the answer.
I saw you mention that in your pre-show planning memo.
Yeah, our pre-show meeting.
And my answer is yes, they can. And now as soon as I said that, okay. I go, how do I know? I'm just a host of a podcast. Oh, yes, they can. But I'm pretty sure they can. And I think, I don't think the rules prohibit that, but I'll have to ask and verify that for my
And of course, another thing that is being kicked around is this idea that they're not going to be able to endorse political candidates anymore. Frankly, I just don't think that's a big deal. I really don't. What do you think about that?
No, I think the whole history of the Sun-Times recently and endorsing candidates, when they stopped doing it for a while and then they brought it back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was clearly when they brought it back, it was to endorse Rauner, who is arguably the worst governor the state of Illinois has ever had. And that includes Rob Blagojevich went to prison. And so this is what they came back to do endorsements for. Just they lost credibility across the board on all fronts with that. I liked your suggestion where the Sun-Times, without doing endorsements, can handle endorsements much like they handle judicial endorsements, where you just have a list of all the people who endorse particular candidates. You get a sense thereof. And you can do, by the way, you can do an analysis of the candidates in the race without officially endorsing someone, you know.
Sure. Well, they were doing that during that time. They were doing very well with that, with doing, interviews with candidates and putting them up against each other and comparing them. And I think that's, that's every bit as much of a public service. And don't forget, as Eric pointed out too, Eric Zorn pointed out, these editorials are just the voice of a couple of money bags people who own the paper. It's not like they poll the staff or something to get, their view on it. So, who really cares what the paper thinks? And again, BEZ has been in the news business now for 40 years or something, and it's obviously never endorsed a candidate, and I don't think anybody there feels that that's a problem, because what they do is they go out and they talk to the candidates and they interview them and they put those interviews together and then they let you decide. So anyway,
I'd like to give a shout out to unions before we leave this topic behind. And
absolutely,
The Sun-Times was bolstered with money from several unions including the Chicago Federation of Labor. Robert Ryder, I see you there. SEIU Healthcare, I see you guys there. And they gave money to the Sun-Times. They pumped money into the Sun-Times at a point when the Sun-Times really needed it. And they did it. I talked to many of them because they said going back to my earlier comments, the Tribune was so virulently and violently anti-union, despicably so. And they felt that if the Sun-Times went out of business, the city of Chicago, the only downtown editorial voice, I guess you can put cranes in there too, would be anti-union voices. And they didn't want that to happen. They wanted at least some semblance of a voice articulating the need for collective bargaining rights. And before you came on, Ken, I had a young worker who's part of the union organizing effort at the Art Institute. And later on today, I'm going to interview some people, some young workers who are part of the unionizing effort at Starbucks. And it just seems to me, again, that if you want to be in touch with people who live in the city of Chicago, you really can't be hostile to unions. And so, I think they saved, the union saved the Sun-Times. Not that anyone's going to give them credit for it. I don't even see them mentioned in any of these stories. So I'll give him a shot.
Just a momentary jumping off of the topic here, because you just lit up a light for me. Our friends at Starbucks, their announcement that they're going to rescind the mask order in order to comply with the Supreme Court ruling, to comply. The Supreme Court didn't say you can't have your workers, you can't, make your workers be safe. They didn't say that. They just said that OSHA can't mandate it.
Yeah.
And I'm just
What do you think they're doing?
I'm smacked by this.
Take the next step. Why do you think Starbucks positions it as complying with a Supreme Court ruling when in fact there's no compliance that they have to follow?
I don't know, Ben. I still can't figure it out. Why would they do that? I mean, I'm figuring that many of Starbucks customers are people who are, I don't know, somewhat left of center. Maybe they're not, but I would think they are. And I would think that many of their customers would be really offended by the fact that they're just saying, you don't have to wear a mask when you come in our store because our workers aren't wearing them.
Yeah.
I just don't get it.
It doesn't make any sense. Again, it's very, Tribune-esque from about 5 years ago, but it doesn't make any sense because you're right. If I always feel like when corporations get involved in political issues, I generally view it as they're making a strategic move in to corner a certain part of the market. Right. So follow me in this game. Yeah. So when Nike made peace with Colin Kaepernick, the quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, who was essentially kicked out of the NFL because he took a knee. When they cut a deal with him and used him in their advertising, it was their way of saying, we're going with the left, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. And if people on the right don't like it, who cares? We could sell enough sneakers to people on the left to be more than profitable.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So when I see Starbucks doing this, I'm like, oh, they're making an appeal to MAGA. Why Starbucks would make an appeal to MAGA? You get what I'm saying? When I'm not certain that Starbucks is really popular in the MAGA part of America. I do not know.
I don't think so, but who knows? Who knows?
But yeah. That was my initial reaction when I saw that.
But when I saw it, my first thought was, wow, you know, they've just had their first, second, and third shops go union for the first time in their history. This is going to drive a few thousand more stores that way because there's going to be a lot of people who work in those stores who are saying, this is nuts.
Yeah.
I want protection. Yes. But anyway, could I just take us back to the newspaper thing for just a minute?
Yes.
Because one of the things that I think is really critical, Ben, and these are things we've got to keep an eye on with this merger. What's going to happen to the Sun-Times paywall? I mean, they are a paywalled operation right now. You and I are subscribers, and even though we both get it delivered to our door, we also have access to their website. Some people have just subscriptions where they're just online subscriptions, of course. But the fact of the matter is that with the Sun-Times, you got to pay if you want to read their content, pretty much. Mm-hmm. There's some that's free, but you know, if you want to read the big important stuff, you've got to pay somewhere. Now, BZ people said, what the board people said, was that they were going to soften the paywall. And I don't quite understand what they mean by that. But, you know, it's one thing to have a public radio audience that has been trained for over 40 years that if you want to do this, if you want to use their content, you're welcome to have it for free. But, oh, by the way, if you got a few extra coins in your pocket, would you send it our way? And that's worked brilliantly for public radio. But for a newspaper that for its entire existence has been, you want to read this, you got to pay. How are they going to suddenly be giving their content away for free? If people, you know, there's this whole thing about, they don't want to block content for those who are unable or unwilling to pay. So that means then, oh, well, you know what? I've been reading sometimes since I was, you know, 12 years old. I don't have to pay for it anymore. I'll just go to the website and I can just read it for nothing. That is going to be a big sort of a cultural issue for blending these two corporations that have just a completely different DNA. You know what I mean? Their audiences have been trained in very different ways.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how that's going to work.
Well, my guess is it'll work this way. A subscription to the Sun-Times, both if you want it through the door to door, like people like you and me, dinosaurs like you and me get it, or if you just want it on your phone or internet, etc., mm-hmm. like most people do these days, will be yours if you give a donation to BEZ. So now they're like, along with the tote bag and the T-shirt, you'll get a subscription.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah, I would guess that's where they're going to go. And so that will build readership. Because think of all, I could tell you this right now. You know, here I am going to do some gross stereotyping that is really unfair, and I apologize for it up front. But most people that I know who listen to WBEZ do not read My Beloved Bright One. And I know this. Right. Ken, right. I know this because when I talk to people, I find out, where did you, I'm always fascinated by, where did you pick that up? Like, where did you get the information that you're now? And so some people say, well, I saw it on my Facebook wall. And they don't know where they just saw it on their Facebook wall. Do you follow them? So right, they got it from Facebook. Right. They didn't even know who gave it to them on Facebook. Okay? Right.
Because Facebook scraped it from somebody who actually had journalists who went out and got it.
Yes.
But that's another discussion.
That's another story. So I can tell you right now that people followed the work of Danny Milopoulos for WBEZ, who did probably don't know that he for years wrote for the Sun-Times. And same thing with Dave McKinnon.
And very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did a great job. And they just, it's like two separate worlds. People who read the Sun-Times and people who listen to BEZ. And so I think it would help the Sun-Times. It would introduce the Sun-Times to some folks who've never even seen it. You know what I'm saying? They know about it. So I think that would help if they put it, if they made it accessible to people who donate to BEZ. That's my guess where they're going. And I'll be honest with you, Ken, and I think you feel the same way. We subscribe to the Sun-Times and the Tribune. I view it as just like a way of supporting an institution that's been a part of my life for
absolutely.
You know, so all right, let's move on and talk about the tribute to Les Grobstein.
Yes, let's do that. I don't really have a tribute to Les Grobstein. All I was saying when we were having our pre-show meeting is that I, like probably you, listen to WLS, WLS, CFL, WYNR, all the radio, everything that's on the radio. And Les Grobstein was one of the great personalities on WLS. When he would get into it with Fred Winston, with Larry Luchak, with even Stephen Gary, who came on a little bit later, it was magical because the guy could just, this is going to sound ridiculous and immodest, but it's kind of like what you and I are doing now. It's just where you can just kind of riff from one thing to another and you just remember these things, or you were at something and you want to talk about it, but then that makes you think of the next thing and that makes you think of the next thing. I love that kind of radio, and Les Grobstein did that. I never have given a damn about sports at all. I just don't know. I barely know what sport the Bulls play, let alone any of their players or anything. But listening to Les Grobstein talk about it was great because it's like, wow, this is really interesting. But I don't know who these people are. But anyway,
I would doubt.
So that's my half-assed comment.
Okay. All right. Well,
tribute.
So I feel like I should have done this when I introduced the topic. Les Grobstein died the other day at age 69. He'd been on Chicago radio since the 70s, so that's a long time.
He was a teenager, right? Like 18 or something. Well, it was when he started calling in.
He is definitely of another era when the radio played a far more prominent role.
Yeah.
In Chicago than it does now. And we've been talking about the passing of these old media entities like the Sun-Times and the Tribune, and radio is in the same situation. Mm-hmm. And so Les Grobstein kept his career going, sports talk, and he had an overnight show on, what was it? What station is he on? The Score. He was on the overnight. So if you were up at 1 a.m. or 2 a.m, as I've been known to be up at 1 or 2 a.m, you could listen to Les Grobstein going on and on about sports. And Ken, there's no reason in the world why you would ever listen to a Les Grobstein show. And I say this with all love for Les Grobstein, because all it is this intense sports talk, obsessive. My kids and my wife, they instructed me years ago that I was not under any circumstances to be able to listen to sports talk when I was in the car with them, because they couldn't stand the sound of it. So you would never, but you only know less because of the days when he would do the 3 minute segment in the middle or a 2 minute segment of sports.
Yeah.
And he would come into the Larry Lujack show or Steve Dahl's show and they would mock him and make fun of him and ridicule him. And they would be putting down not just him, but anybody who cares anything about sports. And that's how a lot of people in town, if they have any memory of Les Grobstein at all, remember him, which developed this new breed of sports writer, which I will now address with you and get your thoughts on. Self-hating sports writers who realize that what they're doing is absolutely ridiculous, obsessing over a child's game, and yet they do it anyway. And so they really made fun of Les Grobstein because he just openly loved it and didn't care what you thought about him.
Yeah.
And made fun of him for how he dressed, how he looked, how he could talk obsessively about sports.
You know, I loved listening to you talking about it. What was it? Day or two ago when that whole thing you did on Les was wonderful for that reason, because I really can't express it, but first of all, I don't know why it never occurred to me that a night owl like you wouldn't have been listening to him on The Score. Of course you would have been, you know, but there's, I just go back to what I was saying before, that there's just something about people who can just kind of pull various things out of their head randomly and just kind of like stitch it all together right in front of your ears. It was really cool. I really admired it.
Yeah, no, he could definitely do that when it came to sports. It was kind of limited to sports and pop music of the 60s and 70s. Yeah. He was really good on that too. All right, we will close with your defense of the transit TIF program, which I could do a whole show on.
I thought you were going to say we'll close now. Sorry, we don't have any more. We have no more time. But
are you kidding? I mean, someone has to discuss the transit TIF, okay? And who else but you and me? Yeah. We probably should have started with this. But the transit TIF was, of course, a way of financing the renovation of the Red Line.
Well, actually, I think, if I'm not mistaken, when Rahm Emanuel presented it, he actually made it as something more for transit in general, because he was talking about eventually when the blue Red Line is completely redone, then they're going to take on the Blue Line. That's what he was saying years back.
Okay. So I was never a really big critic of the transit TIF, Ken. I just want to say this right now for the record, in part because it was designed to cut off criticism from people like me.
Exactly.
Exempted the schools. So Rahm was no dummy. I mean, he may not have had, conscience or anything, but he figured out that he would be really criticized if he used this school money for this project. So essentially what it does is for the next 23 years,
30, what is it? I got to check my notes. It's 35 years.
35 years.
It was a special TIF. It went extra time.
Yeah, to compensate for the money they're not getting from the schools, no doubt.
Right, that's right.
You know, they're not dumb, the people who come up with these things, okay? Just like the people who came up with the devices that ultimately led to the destruction of the Chicago Tribune, as you pointed out, Ken, are not dumb. Yes.
No, oh God, no.
So, I feel like, I mean, I could give it a principled opposition to any kind of TIF expenditure going to finance a public entity, like a school or a park, because it's really supposed to promote private entities and increase the tax base. I can make that argument, but I'm not even going to go down that path.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to say, good for them. They're improving the Red Line. And they're using property taxes to do it. So I just want everybody out there to know that they're raising your property taxes to improve the Red Line. And you have to ask yourself as taxpayers, is that a worthy increase to improve the Red Line? In your opinion, Ken Davis, yes or no, is it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it absolutely is. And I got to say, but I just to make sure that I wasn't going to just make a complete fool of myself here today. I went back and read back through a lot of the TIF documents from then, or whenever that was. I don't have the date in front of me. But it was really interesting that it was the vote in the city council was 48-0. and there was no opposition. And a big part of the reason for it, this is politics for you, the reason why it happened, and I had completely forgotten this, was that it was in December of 19, like 2 or 3 weeks after Trump had been elected. And if you remember, there was just nothing but panic everywhere because they knew that Trump was going to be stopping all of these public programs and, you know, everything else. So apparently Rahm Emanuel got his folks together. I had forgotten all of this. And they said, Barack Obama's still in the White House. There's still transit money available in grants to cities. We can nail a billion of that if we can show that we have the money to, you know, to whatever you want to say, to balance it. You know, like we put something on the table, you put something on the table. The day that the city council passed that legislation, they sent their application into Obama's administration. It was approved the next day, and they got $1 billion back before Trump got into office. So that was the motivation for it. And so in many ways, you can say that all of these really nice things that are happening to the red line right now are thanks to Donald Trump, because he scared the Jesus out of everybody, and they just started working on it.
Well, listen, I remember that argument. It was being advanced by Alderman Patrick O'Connor, the 40th Ward, no longer in the city council, was defeated in 2019. This is like a Les Grobstein riff I'm doing right now.
And so
Alderman Patrick O'Connor, the 40th Ward, was for many years Rahm Emanuel's floor leader. Before that, he was Richard Daley's floor leader. And as such, it was his job to say whatever scripted words the really smart people at City Hall had written for him, people like Peter Cunningham, who was on the show last week.
It sounded like it was his own words.
What's that? Well, O'Connor by this time may have been smart enough to figure out whatever it was he had to say. I would say this to that. Yes, you're absolutely correct that the city of Chicago, in order to be eligible for the federal transit funds that were necessary to rebuild the red line, had to put a skin in the game, as they love to say, skin in the game. You got to put skin in the game, right? So they had to put up some local money. And they seized upon the idea of creating this transit TIF, which would raise money through the property tax, increasing the amount of money we pay in property taxes, with that extra increase being skimmed off to pay for the red line, without telling you, of course, in your tax bill that you're doing this. And it was very clever. And so I applauded it ultimately, because I believed that it was you and Dave Glowatz and people like you convinced me that it was a good idea to invest in our public transportation. So I agreed with that. And I've gone so far now with my attitude toward TIFs is that if the public is not going to recognize them as the tax hikes that they are, and you and I've had this conversation before, Ken, then we should just use them to finance government. We should just create the whole city should be a TIF, and everybody can pretend that we're not paying more in taxes, even though we are. And that'll be a painless way to finance government. We just saw this heated debate on the budget. How much extra dollars are being raised by Lori Lightfoot? And, you know, they bring out these guys who say, well, it's going to add $10 to your property tax bill. They got it down to like the exact amount. But when they pass a TIF, can they never tell you how much it's going to add? It's like magic money. So, Ken, if the public's going to believe in the TIF magic money fairy, who am I? Mm-hmm. Really, who am I to stifle them? You know what I'm saying? Who am I to protest? Let's go on.
Well, it's interesting because the actual transit TIF, and again, I had forgotten this too, is a 1 mile wide swath from North Avenue along the Red Line up to Devon. So it's a half a mile on either side of the Red Line. So a lot of that, not all, but certainly up north, so much of that is these big, you know, 20, 30 unit apartment buildings and stuff. So it's quite likely that the people who are paying their rent in these places just have no idea that some of their money is going through their landlord into the TIF payment for the red line. But then again, they're the most likely to use the red line. So I guess it's all right. I don't know. I can't figure it out.
Well, let me remind you what I always remind people when they go down this road. And first of all, people who live within the TIF will know, because they're the only people who are alert on their tax bill that there's money being siphoned into a TIF fund. A TIF, when you impose a TIF, you raise everybody's taxes. Because you have to compensate for the top property tax dollars you're not getting from the TIF district itself.
Right.
So Ken Davis, who lives somewhere on the northwest side out by Taft High School, I don't know exactly where you live, Ken, but I know it's out there. You're paying every bit as much for that red line TIF as somebody who lives in the corner of Addis Clark.
I have to reimburse the money that didn't get put into the kitty because the people in the red line TIF had took that money. So I've got to replace that money. Yeah. I think you and I had this incredible conversation once on the TV show, the bathtub analogy, that there's just this big bathtub. And it's our job to keep the bathtub filled to the top. And then other people come along with their little dippers or their big buckets and they take money out.
Yeah.
And then we all have to go with our glasses full of water to fill the bathtub back up again, whether we like it or not, because it's our job to keep that bathtub full.
Yes.
So, you know.
That was a great analogy, and I know your ratings tripled for that show. Because people were just, oh, wow, an in-depth discussion of TIFFs. Where do I get to watch this?
Just like the nostalgic guys we are, here we are just doing it again. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So I really never thought about it this way, but what you're basically saying is that the fight over TIFFs has been won.
Yes.
Part of our fabric now.
Yeah. My only issue is how we're spending the money. So, for instance, if I'm going to raise more money to pay more in taxes to finance something, which is what TIF is, you're borrowing money now to pay for something. Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to raise my taxes, I want to believe that whatever I'm paying for, A, we really need, or B, could not be created without that handout. And so I believe we need the red line renovation, and I believe it wouldn't happen without public financing. Lincoln Yards, on the other hand, one, I don't believe we need it, and two, they can pay for it themselves.
I mean, you couldn't find two more extreme examples on one end or the other, you know, of the spectrum, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, there is no justification for Lincoln Yards. There's just none.
Yes.
But there never was, and let's not go down that road.
I lost that fight and a job over it. All right. It's okay. It's all good. I enjoy doing what I'm doing. Ken, it was a blast talking to you. See how much fun this was? See?
Uh-huh.
You did really well.
Oh, thanks.
I think the lesson I've learned is I should let you pick the topics. Okay, that's fine with me.
Actually, Ben, I love doing your show. I really do. My only reticence was just that I just kind of feel, I listen and you've got all your guests are like authorities. They're all experts on things. They're really, really good at what they do. And I'm just like some old gas bag who just has a lot of opinions. I'm not trying to compare myself to you. You understand?
We've both
been talk show hosts in our lives, and you know, so I just feel kind of weird sometimes. Like I can't go on there and express opinions. My opinions are not based in deep research and knowledge that I've done. It's just like opinions that I have. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Well, at least you're sincere, more or less, in your opinions, as opposed to people who just have opinions like chess pieces in a game. Oh, this will position me in such a way.
And you know what they say, Ben? When you can fake sincerity, you got the world in your hands.
Oh, I did not know that was said, but I'll put that on a T-shirt.
Richard M. Daley said that.
I'm not going to make you do an imitation of J.B. Pritzker talking in a Ken Davis voice, which I threaten, or the Dennis's favorite, Barack Obama speaking like Ken Davis.
Yeah.
I find myself,
you know, yeah, well, yeah. So I love that I'm known by the metaverse, that the metaverse actually requested an imitation of me. That was a high point in my life.
Well, it's funny. I actually heard a rumor. I heard a rumor you created the metaverse, right?
Yes.
That's what Ben told me.
I did, but I never get credit for it.
Yeah. Ken Davis. Yeah. Well, here's the thing about Ken Davis. He wants credit for inventing something he didn't invent, the metaverse. And yet I give him credit for inventing the pledge drive at BZ. And he's like, no, I didn't really do it. Some other guy did it. I'm not changing but that. Ben, I'm giving credit. Yes.
Now's your opportunity. We really need your support. Give us a call right now and pledge $45, and I'll make sure that you get this Ben Jarovsky Show hat, which will keep you warm on those winter days. And it'll tell people I am a person of class because I have a Ben Jarovsky hat. There you go. See, we can do that. We can do that for your show. We can start making some money.
Yes, let's start making some. Oh, that'd be something new. Let's make some. Yeah. I got an idea. Here's my idea. Let's borrow a bunch of money and then put that debt into another company. Okay? And then we'll get the money. The other company will hold the debt. They'll go bankrupt. And oh my God, huh? This capitalism really works.
Yeah, and then we get Lori Lightfoot to tiff the whole thing and we're done.
We're done.
We go home.
All right. That has been young Kenneth Davis, as we like to call him. Thank you for your return. It's a blast talking to you.
Talk to you soon, I hope.
Yes. And I want to thank Anna Foyer from the Art Institute for being on the show as well. I want to thank Anna. And, of course, thank the man, the myth, the legend, the pride of joy in all Illinois, without whom the show would be possible. And as Ken Davis and Anna Foyer will tell you, back home in Alton, they call him Dr. D. And the D stands for DeMarvelous. Give yourself a raise. Take it out of petty cash. See you tomorrow, everybody.
That's not correct.